Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast is sponsored by Ashdown Engineering, a British bass amplification powerhouse whose gear is seen on the biggest stages in the world, backing up the biggest bands in the world. But now Ashdown have expanded their expertise into bass guitars. Having teamed up with Master Luthier Dan Lackin, previously of Lackland Basses, Ashdown are now offering five different models of US-designed basses, from classically inspired shapes to completely new designs, fusing vintage sensibilities with all the modern applications a bassist needs. Available in an ever-expanding range of finishes, and all for under £1,000! These instruments are extremely exciting. Check them out at ashdownmusic.com or follow links in the description of this podcast. Hello and welcome to the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast, a podcast by guitar nerds. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by JD Short.
Greetings and salutations.
And Naomi McLeod.
Hello.
Yes, that's right. We're back with another bi-weekly bass episode. We just finished the last couple of weeks. We were counting down our favorite basses in various fields, favorite basses that are currently available, favorite fretlesses, favorite five strings, things like that. That was good. And I noted that our finishing choices were all quite ridiculous, and I think it ended up being like, who can think of the weirdest thing to claim that is the best thing on the market? But it was good. It was good. I tell you what, doing this, because we're on what, episode 6 now of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast.
Yes, 6 this evening.
This is having a really negative effect on me, because doing the Guitar Nerds podcast is fine, because everything's like all, you know, everyone's traditionally minded. I like traditional stuff. That's fine. Valve amps, you know, old Gibsons, things like that. That's the discussion point. That's the standard. And that's what I've been hemorrhaging money on since doing the Guitar Nerds podcast. And since we've been doing this, I've started being like, maybe I need to buy some EMGs and retrofit them into my jazz bass. So I've done that. And then I'm starting to be like, maybe active is okay. And I'm starting to get, you know, I'm starting to get into, you know, like things like the Spectres and modern stuff, the NS designs that we were talking about. It's definitely making me become, like, I even had a conversation with a luthier this week about commissioning a custom-built version of the Warwick Buzzard.
That's, wow,
that
Joe.
Is quite true. So I'm definitely, something's happening here. This is having an impact into my sort of reserved classicness of my taste.
I give it two or three more episodes and you're going to be telling us about your new six string.
Yeah.
I'm calling it now.
Yes, yeah, so potentially. I have always wanted a bass five. I think that's still...
Yeah, you know. I get that for sure.
Have you ever played one?
I haven't. I haven't even seen one. IRL, unfortunately. So yeah. No, but I've been super intrigued. And to be honest, intrigued even as to what the main draw was for them at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting idea. They were so, like, made for 3 years, I think between 63 and 66, and the bass five was a 15 fret five string bass guitar with a high C, And it was so unpopular that Fender discontinued it very shortly, which means there are very few of them, and very few of them especially make it over to the UK, so they're hard to come across. And they seem to just be getting more and more expensive. A few years ago, I saw one at something like the Birmingham Guitar Show, and it was like $2,500. And that is cheap for one of these. And it wasn't in great condition, which I love. It was super used. Someone had loved it. But I think at the time I just purchased the, I think I mentioned it on the last podcast, the short scale hollow body Gibson Memphis Les Paul Gold Top.
Yes, bass, you had mentioned.
Which was really, I just bought that, which was a chunk of money, and I was like, I have nothing, I cannot purchase this. But they're very cool, very cool. I remember the advertising campaign for those. It had like a guy sat on a tractor, and he had his Bass 5 in the sort of footrest next to him on the tractor, and the tagline was, "You won't part with yours either," which I thought was
nice. So it didn't quite make the surf aesthetic that so many of the other Fenders of the time did. They obviously were going for the more
farmers.
The farmer demographic.
What do bass players do?
Yeah. When I think of farmers, I'm always like 5-string basses, high C.
Exactly. It's a weird thing to not take off, though, isn't it? Like a high C. Don't you think that's a better idea than a 4-string? Sort of being able to move across the board rather than up the board? Like, doesn't that make sense?
Well, I mean, from like an upright perspective, like for upright players, it's much more common to move up and down, so to like stay on the same string and just move through positions. So I think probably around that time still, like electric bass guitar is still newish. You know, like
it's less than a decade old.
So it's probably still thinking about the moving up and down, still probably just playing on like the A, E string, you know, or like staying on like a string. So it's probably still more vertical than like, I'm guessing than sort of today where where sweep picking is a thing that everyone knows about. And, you know, most people can do if they, you know, or will be able to do now. So for the next time they go to a guitar shop. So,
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's a real shame. I was a big fan of the high C. It's something I'd love to make work. Did you guys see? Do you remember Ibanez reissued one in their BTB series, like maybe 5 years ago? I think it was called the BTB 333.
Oh, let's have a look.
I think it was like a 33-inch scale 5-string with a high C, and it even came with a ramp in between the two. I can't remember. I think it was. Was it Bartolini's or was it just sort of their own proprietary pickups? I can't remember. It was great. I've always secretly loved the BTB shape, but I could never work out if it was because I hate the SR shape. The SR just looks like too much like a sucked sweet.
Yeah.
And the BTB just had some character.
I used to have an SR that I really enjoyed, like one of the upper end, like the 800 or, you know, 1200s or whatever, one of those. It was really good, but I definitely get the suck sweet shape of or it just looks like, well, I was holding it and it got really warm and melty.
I did buy one once, an SR. I think it was a 1200. They were like babinga, like the neck was like 8-piece, and it was like an Evancol top, I think, and it had gold hardware, like monorail bridge. And I think it was Nordstrand pickups. I think that's why I bought it, actually.
Yeah.
It was because I think for you, JD, I think Nordstrand had probably occurred in the States quite a lot. And over here, it was just non-existent. And then this Ibanez came out with a pair of Nordstrand soap bars. And you plugged it in and you were like, oh my God, these are the most articulate pickups I've ever heard. And so I, you know, bought it off of the back of that.
Yeah. I mean, I've said it here too, but like Nordstrand, I've never been displeased by putting Nordstrands in, even on basses I've put many different pickups in. It's always been like, and that's it, you know? So like they're great. And like, in Southern California is like where Carrie's shop is. It was, I think they're definitely much more in the US, and Ibanez was really one of the big ones that made them kind of well known, I think, or just made them accessible, like in a way that you could get them in a stock instrument.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because before then, yeah, I think the only time I'd seen them was, I've mentioned this rig rundown before, but Juan Aldrete's rig rundown from the Nocturnicut tour with the Mars Volta. And he has a, he brings out a jazz bass where he's had, I think, it's a P bass where he's had an extra Nordstrand soap bar fit into the bridge of the P bass.
Nice.
And that was like, that was the first time I'd ever even heard the name Nordstrand. And of course it was coming from Juan Aldrete, so, you know, it seemed like a sensible thing to get on board with. But yeah, they are very, very good. Naomi, in our, before we go into our main topic, you've you popped in our notes a very interesting instrument that's come to your attention.
Yeah, I did indeed. So in my weekly perusings ahead of our next episode, I spotted that Eastwood have reissued a tribute rather to the Echo Rocks bass, the arrow shaped, that super distinctive arrow shaped body. They're calling it the Rocket Bass. Hark back to the 60s design brought out by the band The Rokes. And I believe as well was the very first time that a signature guitar, signature body shape was actually built for a band.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This is the first signature body shape. Well, I mean, I guess technically Les Paul is the first signature body shape. But,
of course, yeah.
But still, bass, maybe this well is.
Exactly. and perhaps outside of the sort of kind of mass market, the kind of mass production that we ended up with the Les Paul body shape. So yeah, super cool. It's 30.5 inch scale length. It's got a chambered mahogany. Yeah, tone chambered mahogany body. I love it already.
It's so ridiculous looking. I mean, it is rocket shaped.
It almost looks like one of those hilarious photos where someone's like photoshopped the bass the other way around, so like the headstock's the body and the body's the headstock, like one of those huge, those I'm sure you were all in bass groups everywhere, but it sort of feels like the body shape should be the headstock and then the headstock is just
wild. It's got an outward, a concave, convex pointing headstock.
That headstock is incredibly pointy. It goes to
that's fine dangerous
point. Yeah, that's gonna bust through some gig bags for sure. I'm just super intrigued overall. I like that this was a shape. I'm not surprised that it was a pretty far out shape back in the 60s, but I love that they've reissued this not once but twice. They brought it out, I believe, in 2006. Eastwood rather, and now we're bringing it back for a run. Expected to ship early next year. It's like, you know what it's a bit like, do you guys know the app Facetune that people have used to conduct all manner of autonomous photographic plastic surgery? It's like a flying V shape face tuned itself.
Yeah. Like it was like, oh, not so pointy here, but I wonder, exactly the flying V is what I kept thinking of. So like where the bridge sort of meets the very end of the body, that scooped, like the flying V, like, do we think that's for your arm to go around? like those flying Vs, you know, like where you're supposed to be like, you put your arm through the V. Yeah.
That is the way you play them. The guy from the Kinks played it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if this is supposed to be the same, but it also, like, the... I'm not at all bagging on this because I the more I talk about this, the more I really like it. But it feels like it's very like a late, well, maybe early 70s, like sci-fi, where it's like you're in a space band, but you're still making a guitar from like this 60s style. Like someone in a prop shop was like, we need a spacey looking bass. And it's like, I don't know, cut weird shapes out of this already existing bass.
It does look home done.
Yeah, someone went weirder. No, weirder.
But that's what Eastwood do. I mean, I know Eastwood as a brand, they do reissues that other brands have done before, and often on a sort of crowdfunder basis, which is really cool. But they've, I mean, you know, if you guys go to eastwoodguitars.com/collections/bass, then you can have a flick through their incredible range of instruments. And they really are incredible. I mean, they're one of, they're probably the only company that you can get an EB1 reissue, yeah, the original Gibson bass. Now, unfortunately, they've done something that I disagree with. They've actually made it hollow. Now, the EB1 by Gibson was their violin bass, but for Gibson, it was a solid body and they just had painted on F-holes. It is actually a hollow body in the case of the East Wood, but it does come with the kick stand, so you can play it like a double bass. It's like a pole that attaches to the lower strap button, and then you can stand it up and play it like a double bass, which is very cool.
That is very cool. Yeah, I mean, they've a pretty diverse. I mean, they've their Magnum bass coming soon, which is like the
what's the Magnum bass?
It's like that Ovation bass.
Oh, the
what is the super famous?
Yes, breadwinner. I almost said wife beater, but no, breadwinner. That's it. It's completely different. Yeah, that was cool. That Ovation bass was great, and it's really, this is the great thing about Eastwood. They're always really good prices because those Ovations always go for like a couple of grand.
Mm-hmm.
So that is very, very cool. They also do they've got a couple of six string sort of bass six style things. They're doing the Eastwood hooky bass, which is the maddest thing that Shergold Guitars haven't done since Shergold Guitars have come back. Shergold Guitars, probably most famous instrument is Peter Hook's six string bass six.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Shergold exists, there is no bass six in the Shergold lineup, which is crazy.
A shame.
But that's cool that they're doing one of those. They also do their own, another bass six version as well, their TB64, which looks fantastic. I often think about purchasing.
Yeah, they do a sweet like apple green finish in that one as well, which is very tasty. Very tasty lineup across many, many body shapes, which I like to see in a brand that does things as well as Eastwood do. So yeah, that was my weird and wacky corner for this week.
Yeah. Yeah. That is that is exactly what that is. Man, this has made me get excited about Eastwood basses again.
Oh. Yeah, me too. I also I feel like we should trademark the Naomi's weird and wacky corner.
Should I make a jingle for it?
Yeah.
I'll make a jingle for it. There we go. That's done.
I can hold my breath really long. I should.
Yeah, there you go. That's.
Hold on. This is comedy
gold. Sampling. I'm just sampling all of this. But yeah, no, I'm 100%. I'm making a jingle, and we're gonna do Naomi's Weird and Wacky Corner every week.
Awesome.
Well, every other week.
And it's gonna be an Irish trad jingle, isn't it, Joe?
Oh, can I do that? Oh, that's not. Yeah, I'm doing. Okay, there we go. This is fine.
I'll permit it. I'm now on the record having permitted it. So any shame brought upon my nation is on me.
Wonderful. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Now, there's a ton of things to get through this week. I do briefly want to mention, even though I did talk about it on the Guitar Nerds podcast because I just got carried away and excited. But did you guys see Billy Sheehan's 30th anniversary Yamaha Attitude?
The wife.
It's... Yeah, the Yamaha's version of the wife.
Yeah.
Super
handsome looking bass. It's
really
beautiful.
Good. I've always, that's always been my problem with the Attitude, is that it's just a bit too, never liked the sort of how modern it looked, even though features wise it's really cool and classic. And obviously the Attitude is very similar to, you know, the wife, which was Billy Sheehan's original P bass that he, you know, retrofitted a Gibson EBO pickup into and had them routed to different outputs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he'd filed down those little scallops in his fretboard all himself. The Attitude is very close to that, but not in the way it looks. It looks very modern. I've never really got too much time to play an Attitude. Like, it's, we had a couple sort of come and go at GAC because they were about $2,000, and you had to, I think Yamaha more or less made them to order, so they're rarely turned up. They had huge necks on them. I know a friend of yours and mine, Naomi Jo Thorpe, plays an attitude these days.
He does indeed.
Is he playing it as his lead main bass now? Do you know?
He's a man of many basses, but I do think the attitude has come out front. He's got the standard, and then he's got the limited two, I think. He's got two. He has indeed got two. When one attitude isn't enough, you know, you've got to spread the love.
Ridiculous.
So I was a huge fan of the standard, actually, the very budget model.
Oh really?
Yeah, it plays stunningly. I mean,
so does that just have a P bass pickup?
Does it have? I'm gonna have to go in and look now because I have played both, but you know, it's no surprise to me with Yamaha that the build quality was as it is, even in their cheaper instruments. Like, I've always been a great advocate of the budget BBs. In my days working in stores and stuff. But just like super fast, awesome player. Big neck, big chunky neck on both of them.
Yeah, very chunky.
Which wouldn't be for everyone. But no, just in terms of the I don't know, the kind of, I suppose, alternative functionality of the dual output, I was pretty sold on that even when I first heard of it. It's What do you think? Have you owned an attitude? Have you played many or
hardly played any? The to be honest, the dual output for me was the turnoff, because I was like, I mean, have you ever, you know, tried to present a sound guy with a double bass rig?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, they'd just be like, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this?" Like, it's just, it's the sort of thing that's like, this bass is fantastic if you have an infinite amount of money, roadies, and you're only playing stadiums. If you are not conforming to all these three things, it may be a bit overkill. But it does look and sound very good. I'm a massive Billy Sheehan fan. Like, he really got me into actually trying to play properly, sort of thing. Because I was like, oh, a bass player who's not sort of being funky but is good. You know, he's
absolutely, and he does bring something totally different to the table.
Yeah,
and he's mod crazy. Like, you know, he's such an advocate of changing and updating and tweaking until something is exactly the tool he needs to play what he wants to play. And I really admire that in him.
Yeah,
I think he's a must see for anyone who's just opening their eyes to the world of the wonderful world of mods.
For sure. Do you know, he was, I think, the first artist to have his bass, I can't remember what they called it, it was Yamaha's artificial aging process for woods. So they used to do it for their top-end pianos, their grand pianos, and it was like, it's basically a chamber that the wood goes into, and it has a load of heat and different conditions applied to it, which artificially makes the sap crystallize in the same way that it does in old wood.
Wow.
And so it's a treatment that they'd only ever done on, you know, ridiculously expensive pianos in order to replicate old pianos.
Yeah.
But for Billy Sheehan's Yamaha Attitude, they started doing that. They started artificially aging the bodies to make them even closer to the, you know, his original 60s P bass, which I thought was super cool.
I'm looking at it here. So torrefaction is what they were doing.
Yeah,
thermo curing, which speeds up the natural process of aging the top wood. Actually, with the new model, is the neck on it roasted maple?
Yeah, I believe so.
Because
it's certainly vintage tinted. If not that, I think it might be a vintage tint, but because it's satin, because it is a satin finish, it might look roasted. I'm not sure.
Sure.
Very cool. I kind of saw that, and I was, because it's Sunburst Torque Guard. It's, you know, a chrome neck pickup instead of the, you know, sort of the black one, the Willpower, I think that one's called. And it was just, it looked so fantastic. I was like, oh, here's an attitude I might buy. But of course, there were 30 of them, and I can't remember what they were. How much were they? Like 30 grand each, something like that.
I didn't realize it was that high.
It might not be that.
They're
much.
Like seven.
Oh, is it
7,000 US? Yeah.
Yeah, that's. Still,
I mean, still, yeah. But I mean, but it really speaks to the whole, like we were talking about with the mods, where it feels like what I want the whole idea behind like a Fender style bass to me is the utilitarianness of it, and that you shouldn't be afraid to just be like to root out a pickup cover or to do something bonkers under, you know, like with like having multiple outputs or everything. Like that's because they're all sort of like planks of wood, much for muchness in a sense. I know I say that and we will discuss the grain density on ash for an hour and a half, but you know, at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, but do all this stuff. Like there's freedom in doing all this stuff. And the fact that it just looks like a sunburst, like P bass with, you know, like all kinds of crazy stuff done to it just feels, it feels super cool and feels like something, again, it's something that I would like to aspire to do to a bass, but I don't have time. And if, like, let's say I also have $7,000 to drop on a bass like this, but like, let's say I did, and I'd be like, oh, well, that's fine. But, you know, hopefully it's, if someone sees that this is what something can do and it's actually desirable, right? Then it's like, well, maybe I do that to my bass. Like maybe I pick up a, you know, an excellent mid-range or cheaper Fender style bass and then be like, well, I have this extra pickup lying around from swapping out, you know, like other pickups here and there, or I got it, you know, for a song somewhere. And yeah, I really like the idea of multiple outputs, if nothing else, just like, just for recording. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like if you take out, you take separate outputs, right? You could take both pickups, pan them hard left, hard right, and then just see what you're doing. So in essence, you're double tracking kind of without really doing, you know, it's super flexible like that. Like I think there's so many actually reasonable things to do besides just, you know, playing a stadium with, you know, like with a biamp system.
I guess you're absolutely right. It is just an extra level of flexibility and being able to send the pickups and treat the pickups individually because they're, you know, I think especially in a bass over a guitar, those pickups have a very different impact on sort of the overall EQ of, you know, the overall hi-fi of what a track is sounding like, you know.
I mean,
yeah. Absolutely.
Just imagine taking that neck pickup and shoving like massive amounts of fuzz on it, right? And being able to use your regular P pickup as just like a regular clean P sound.
For clarity.
But then being able to like just dial in any amount of fuzz at any point, you know, based on, you know, like even with a passive, you know, like volume pedal, right? Yeah. You could.
I guess you were right. There are
tons of options. We should get one of these.
Rickenbacker do that as well?
The old Ricco sound. Yeah,
yeah. That was, you know, for separate. Yeah, everything went into two separate things. Do you know if the Attitude is the same setup? As in, because the Ricco sound, you could plug two things in, but one of the inputs, if you didn't plug something into the separate input, it would take both pickups.
Yeah, I don't know on the Attitude, actually. I think so. I mean, I feels like that's just, it's got to be, because that's a much, to make it a workable bass in most situations, you would want to be able to just be able to blend the pickups, I would think.
Yeah.
But then have the flexibility of having sort of left and right or, you know, high, low, outs or something.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Now, I guess as our, you know, speaking of Fender alikes, there you go. There's a little segue in there. our main topic for this week, I wanted to talk all about Bass Center's bass collection range and really kind of the concept of Fender alternatives. Now, I think the concept of Fender alternatives is such a massive, all-encompassing conversation point that it's something we'll probably dive deeper into maybe another week, because we've also had some great questions on the Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/guitarnerdsforum. I mean, some wonderful questions for this week, so we're going to try and answer some of those. So maybe we'll just talk about Bass Center, the wonderful London shop Bass Center, and their own range bass collection, which is absolutely fantastic. The bass collection range are essentially a series of Fender style basses, but They do a massive range. They do the Jive bass, which is kind of their J bass. And I love that that, as a standard, comes with like the ashtray over the neck pickup, but not over the bridge. They do their power bass, which has the opposite of, well, it, obviously the power bass is their precision bass, and it just has the ashtray on the bridge. And then they do their Detroit bass, which is, I'm very, very into the Detroit bass. The Detroit bass comes with all ashtrays, vintage colors, flat wound strings, and is absolutely like it, inspired by sort of James Jameson, you know, James Jameson, his P bass, and that tone. And that is what they're, you know, that's what they're going for. In fact, I think the Sunburst one actually says James Jameson tribute on the back. I think that's right. But they also do a Purple Haze, which is their version of Burgundy Mist, which is my favorite color.
It's a joke, really. It's just funny you hadn't mentioned it before, but it's good to know. It's good
there
to know.
There you go. But one of the coolest things they do is their British Masters series, British Bass Masters, where they do signature models for basically all the bass players who really should have Fender signature models, but for some reason don't. And I just think, this is kind of why I wanted to talk about this. I was like, man, you know, Bass Collection are absolutely on the money. Yeah. Like, way more than Fender are at the moment. Well, you know, Fender are going after something different at the moment. They, you know, they want all the kids playing them, and that's fine. A Bass Collection have gone, hold on, so you mean Guy Pratt, the guy who's famous for playing a Burgundy Mist jazz bass, who has literally played on every single popular record you can ever think of, who has been the Pink Floyd bass player since like 1988, doesn't have a signature Burgundy Mist jazz bass with EMGs? Well, we'll do that then. And so they did a Burgundy Mist matching headstock, EMG loaded, Guy Pratt Betsy bass for £595. And surprisingly, it sold out as soon as they launched it. They're very cool. But there's also, like, you know, another, you know, they do a Blockheads bass. In fact, they've done a couple of sort of Blockheads basses, because I think they did the Rhythm Stick as well.
Yep. I love all the bass center stuff, because it is all that. Again, I was just talking about like taking a Fender alike and being able to do stuff to it. But it's like, I think they're roughly what, around five hundred pounds or something like that. Like,
you can pick up the non-artist models for like 400.
Yeah, it's but like the Guy Pratt, like a Burgundy Mist bass. I mean, I'm here for it all day, every day.
It's EMG loaded.
I don't understand a lot of times. And we were talking about this before the show. Like, when I came over and played shows a few years ago, and Bass Center lent me a Bass Collection basses for that. And it's the first time I'd really ever played them. And they were every bit as good as every bass I've played. It's just like, there's such a sweet spot for everything. Like, they're just really good, really good basses for incredible values.
Yeah, that's it. I'm kind of the mind, like, of all the Fender alikes, with maybe the exception of Marcus Miller Sires, everything we'd talk about on the Fender alike thing would be like, here's a Fender alike brand making a similar thing for £1,500, for £2,000, you know, for that sort of money. And we'd be like, yeah, they're really, really good. But there's no one that we're going to be talking about other than these guys who are making something that's actually incredible quality. And they are, you know, the price of Squires. I'd buy one of these over a Squire every day of the week.
Yeah.
I think there's so much character to them.
Yeah, they're really characterful, and like, well, not unlike Marcus Miller and the more recent kind of M7 models, they're super on the money just in terms of finishes and appointments as well. Like, it's just so nice to see Fender likes outside of, you know, your kind of black, your Olympic white, your Sunburst, and your Naturals. You know, you've got the matching headstock factor, which is super attractive. The black and blocks has the 70s style neck on the Jive there.
Oh yeah, that was the one that Freak Place played, wasn't it?
Was it Maple
and Black Blocks? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was. I don't know if it was a signature model or if it was just the model he was playing.
But, yeah. Yeah, but just super attractive. I can't wait to try one of these at some point.
I really think I want. I kind of do want the obviously I want the Guy Pratt. It's got EMGs. It's Burgundy Mist. It's very, very cool. But I'm finding myself very drawn to the Frankenstein, the Entwistle inspired model.
Oh, the one that looks like a buzzard? just bringing it back.
Yeah. Well, that is actually why I've been listening to a lot of Entwistle recently. I think it's because I've got this Ashdown Lowrider, which is obviously their sort of non-reverse Firebird Fenderbird, much like what John Entwistle played and had signature models with from Dean, and I think a few other people did signature models of that style for him as well. But I've been playing that a lot, and it kind of. If you sling high and play a guitar where a bass where the strap button isn't over the 12th fret, so it's further back, so it pushes that bass out. It forces you to kind of stand like John Entwistle, and then that makes you sort of play not like him, but sort of certainly feel like that when you're playing. And I was like, man, this is cool. I really like how sort of standoffish this is, and sort of outward. It makes you feel very outward when you're playing. I was like, yeah, I want John Entwistle things, hence why I've been trying to get myself a custom shop buzzard recently. But the Frankenstein is cool, like a Fiesta Red precision bass with a maple jazz neck. I'm into that. That sounds right up my street.
And a super slim neck it boasts as well.
Yeah, very that's cool. Very, very cool. I don't. I think I'm gonna have to get one. I would. Oh God, I might end up with the Detroit bass though. It comes with flats. I know you could just put flats on any of these, but that might actually be a selling point for me.
I mean, the fact that like they're so cheap, the strings that comes with like is a fairly decent percentage of the bass. Like for like when you really look down, looking at it, it's like, ooh, that's what, 5-10% of this?
10% almost. Yeah, it's crazy, right?
Well, the Guy Pratt's got, you know, 165-pound EMGs.
I mean, the Guy Pratt, if they make more of those, that and the Blockhead, like, I'm really interested in that. Basically, any of these Master Series, save for the Bill Wyman, I think is probably not necessarily my vibe. But
the Bill Wyman's a real weird one. For a guy who had such incredible taste in basses when he was younger, he's really failed with his signature model.
I have seen him play a bass very similar to that. I mean, I've seen him play this one. But, you know, like, it is definitely one of those, like, okay, that's cool. I mean, it does kind of give you the 60s, we haven't really established body shapes yet. This might be from a slide guitar. Who knows? You know, kind of those vibes. But, yeah, I just get when he used to play the Steinberger, like the graphite ones, get one of those.
Yeah, exactly. I think if I was going to spend £595 on this Bass Center Bill Wyman with a massive, awful red scratch plate that you would definitely never be able to sell for more than £200, I think I'd probably just buy a Steinberger.
I mean, dentists love Rolling Stones.
Yes, fine. I love the Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. I absolutely, Keith Richards he says so himself. He listens to the podcast. He says so himself that he's a better bass player than he is a guitarist. So there you go. Yeah, I mean, that's why all the important Rolling Stones records have him on bass. Mm, but
one more thing that Keith Richards and I have in common.
There you go.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more.
That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I don't know. What would you? What would each of you buy from the base collection set range?
I'm pretty taken with the Frankenstein, like you said yourself, Joe. And yeah, definitely would be the. Well, wait. Sorry. Are we in the? Are you talking British Base Masters or overall?
Well, you can choose anything from anything the base collection do.
I'm pretty into the Purple Haze Detroit base, I'll be honest. And I've steered well clear of any manner of kind of pink finish or similar the years.
It's
okay. <Yeah. laughs> Thank you. Well, they actually called the Frankenstein salmon pink, I'll have you know. So good luck with that, I'll say. but yeah, I can feel the vibe. Yes, it's a repro of an old thing with the kind of Jamerson tribute, but I would be dying to try one of those. One of the Detroits for me.
Yes.
Very cool.
They are incredibly cool. I think the same. I think I'm going to buy this Purple Haze Detroit base. I know I'm going to have to take those ashtrays off.
That would have been my first thought as well.
No, I don't want to. I recently fitted them onto my 50s. I've got a 50s, the Mexican 50s P bass. I bought it in Fiesta Red. Actually, I didn't buy it. Emma, my girlfriend, bought it for me. It was one of the first things that, you know, she bought me after we were living together. And she went to, like, we were living in Chichester. She got the train to Brighton, bought this thing. She's very short, and she had to get this bass on her back, get it all the way back to Chichester. So it's got some sentimental value for me, but it's had maybe 5 or 6 different pickups fitted. I had the finish stripped off, and I had it redone in a two-tone nitro sunburst. I've got the gold anodized plate on there. I sanded the neck myself into a soft V out of the sort of normal fixed deep C that it has. So it's had lots of things done to it, but I recently put popped ashtrays on it. It's currently got a Seymour Duncan quarter pounder in it, and I took it to a band practice a few weeks ago to play, and I was as amazing as it looked and as fun as it was to play, like, around the house. As soon as I had to do, like, complicated proggy things, having those ashtrays on made it nearly impossible to play, and I had to just go and ask for a screwdriver from the front counter and take the middle one off at least.
I hear that for sure. I think anything outside of super traditional index finger, middle finger style playing is going to be tough with those ashtrays on, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the shame.
I think that's interesting because, like, I really like ashtrays, and I had ashtrays on one of my jazz basses.
So it works on a jazz bass, but sorry, carry on.
I found it was much easier to do a lot of the proggier, semi-pointless techniques that I do a lot of times, you know, and, like, I found it much easier to slap and everything with the ashtrays because I was anchoring my hand on that and I could use it, you know, like, use all the, like, 3-4 finger picking, like thumb and finger picking techniques, like right. flamenco style stuff, and everything was like super easy with it. But yeah, you're right. The placement is probably a bit would make a big difference.
Yeah, yeah. I did find it easier on a jazz bass just because the, and this is very pedantic, but I really need to anchor my thumb when I play with my fingers, and the jazz bass pick guard comes in slightly closer to your low E string, and so, and if you've got a thick pick guard, which I do on my P basses, on my jazz basses, you can anchor on the end of that and it's fine. But on the P bass it's further away, so you can't really do it. And in the case of the 57, well, the 50s one that I've made look like a 57, those gold anodized plates are really thin, so you can't really anchor on them, so it just leaves you with nowhere to go. And I've never found, you know, thumb rests, they're too big. They just get in the way. They affect your follow through.
Yep.
That's a terrible
term.
It's
too much where the pick guard is too little in your case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I don't know. I might just try it anyway, because this, for £495, buy it now, a Burgundy Miss flat wound loaded matching headstock P bass. Like, imagine if Fender did this with this spec. You know, imagine the price tag that would be on that. You know, it would be very, very different.
I was imagining it at that price tag and how that would actually break the internet, or in my eyes at least. Can you imagine? It would be awesome.
Yeah, it would do indeed. Right. I think we should answer some questions anyway from the Facebook group, because we've got quite a few. Should we pick one each? JD, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Also, I was going to say I'd probably get the blockhead, assuming we're
I'm so sorry.
It would be the Guy Pratt one, because he's just ace and it's lovely. But failing that would be the blockhead.
Which blockhead?
The gold one.
There's two, aren't there?
The gold one.
The jazz bass version.
Yeah, right. Jazz bass version matching headstocks. I think that one's dope. I was going to do a hilarious thing where I was like, do you mean bass collection or bass center? Because bass center also has the entire NS design range. And then I was going to be like, oh, it'd be the NXTA radius bass.
I had put that on the list of things to discuss, because they've got really involved in NS.
They have the complete collection of NS design instruments.
It's not just the complete collection. Like, they've got, I didn't realize, but because NS Design do a lot of like electric double basses, you know, the things that don't have any bodies, you know, they're just the whole thing.
Beside me right now.
Oh, yes, of course. They do a range of support systems, including one that allows you to play one of those as in a normal sort of electric bass thing, like a strap system.
Yeah, there's...
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, there's a lot. Well, they also have the Omni bass, which is like the shorter version. Oh, it's a shorter scale length version that is... I'd have to double check, but I think that may be the one that like sort of sits on your body.
Is the one I'm looking at. Sorry, I thought it was a strap system, but no, you're right. It is just that this Omni bass can be played...
Which...
The advertising stuff for it's so good. Like, the people that are playing Omni basses are exactly the people I expect to be playing Omni basses. It's wonderful. There's like a massive sort of like a big fat bearded lumberjack guy, and then there's like a guy in sort of V for Vendetta makeup. Like, it's there's some sort of cowboy. Wonderful.
Yeah,
I'm into this.
Yeah, I mean, those are also great too. Just, I mean, if anything, like for those, I look at them as they basically have the upright radius, so you can do arco like bowing techniques. But they also have like an electric bass style scale length, as opposed to like the 40 plus inch scale length you get on like a 3/4 upright and everything. So it's sort of like that happy middle ground if you don't want to completely change everything and kind of, you know, like still play electric spacing and everything play like that. But
it's a great idea. They do a fretted version, which seems weird. Those frets must be super curved. They are. I can see someone playing a fretted one. That's That is, it seems like you're taking out half the fun, but
yeah, I mean, unless you're the rest of the band getting used to someone who trying to play Arco fretless who hasn't played Arco or fretless, you know,
yeah,
like,
true. Yeah,
yeah. Singers love a fretted note if you're not right on the pitch there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's incredible. They do the whole range and, you know, like including the super cool basses that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. You know, starting at £907 for the WAV4. In matte black, which is
so good.
Very good.
I adore them so much.
And they are really cool. Really cool range of instruments. Anyway, yes, we did cool. say before I tried to cut JD off, we did say we were going to take questions from the Facebook group. So yeah, so let's each pick a question, I guess, to answer. JD, did you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. And the question that I remember seeing that stuck out the most to me was really about speaker configurations and cabinets.
Yes, yes.
Was mm-hmm. where was the, you know, the 18, 16, 215s.
That's right. Yeah. So Brandon Ivy. Brandon Ivy had asked, you know, he'd said quite simply 810, 610 or 215. And Sam Brooksby had added to that saying or 212. So, yeah, where do we sit on the cabinet choice for the tones that we play?
I would say, thinking of this purely as tone, well, actually, I don't know. So 610s, I would say, is sort of my cool cabinet of choice, because it's I really like 610 cabs, and that 810s are great. I don't often really need something that massive. And like six, but I also like the look and feel and sound of something a bit more than like a 410. And usually with 410s, like if you're going to get a 410, you usually end up getting an 8-ohm cabs. You can do two of them and go to 4 ohms, where a lot of the 610 cabs will just be 4 ohm straight out of the gate. So you can get, you know, you're using more power of your head without it. You're not necessarily, if you're just using a single cabinet, I really like 610s. I've been a big fan of, like, I think 10s are my favorites.
What makes, because that is kind of the industry standard, like every bass player seem to love a 10. What makes you drawn to the 10?
With the 10, for me, it's, one, I think there's a misnomer in that you can actually get a lot more low end out of the 10s, because when there's more of them, they're doing less work and there's more surface area, so you're getting more volume, mm-hmm. which like surface area is the measure of volume. For my playing, I really like the attack of 10s, and this is getting really specific, I think, but I've played most things. Like I've had, again, we've talked about this before. I grew up in the land of PV, so I have had a 118 cab, and I've had different flavors of single 15, 215s. I've never actually owned a 212, but I've played them a lot, and there are some that I really like. But I still think, like, for me, like the articulation that I get from the 10s are really it. And I would say it would either be a 410 or a 610, ideally. Those are harder to come by, but that would be, 610 is really if you're just looking at a single cab kind of thing. And I mean, 810s are classic, but I think there's just something about a 610 that I think is really, really cool. And then I would probably say 212, 810.
610s are definitely kind of underrated, I think, because, you know, I guess people think of the 810 as being the ultimate, and then the 410 as being the portable version of that. So it's kind of, it's in this odd place in the middle where not a lot of companies make 610s, and sometimes they get lost a little bit. Naomi, what do you think?
So I'm trying to think what I've actually played through the most on balance. I know for a ton of gigs I've been supplied with 810s. They've kind of been the go-to for sort of heavier music or whatever.
What do you own?
What do I own? So currently, I actually answered incorrectly, I think, in episode one in saying I was cabless. I was doing a great disservice to the cab that I do, in fact, own. It's what happens when I get put on the spot. But I'm down at the moment to just an absolute bare bones function gig setup, which is it's a mark base. Is it a Traveller 210? Traveller 102P, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm a good big chance. Fan of. Yeah. Really like it for the sort of stuff that I've had to play with it. I wouldn't necessarily consider it a worthy opponent of every style, maybe. But what I did have before that, and I sold on purely because I was moving country, was an EBS Classic Line 212, which I absolutely loved. It was gorgeous.
What a fantastic cabinet.
I think I'm going to buy one again, to be honest with you.
Absolutely.
Huge fan, thought it sounded absolutely beautiful. It for me, the draw for the draw for 12-inch speakers with me is I feel like they're kind of the happy balance between definition and resonance.
Right.
That's just me, and that's just whatever I happen to have played through that configuration. I completely understand the draw with 4x10s, that they're portable. I think 4x10s kind of get the best rep for punchiness. Whereas I suppose personally, I've found a really attractive kind of punch factor against resonance with the 2x12 configuration. So that would be my vote. And in fact, in Brandon Ivy's question on the group, Sam Brooksby responded with a link to the Barefaced Big Twin 2, which would get my vote every time as well.
It's a very good cab, the Barefaced Big Twin 2. It's an extremely good example of a 212.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, you know what, I kind of feel the same about 212s. I remember the first time I started hearing sort of 212 bass cabs, I kind of feel like they sounded like 810s, but small and portable. They had that same sort of balance, like exactly as you say. It was that balance of like clarity and, you know, sort of, but not quite as... I kind of feel like everything becomes a little bit trebly with 210s and 410s. I know that's not, you know, that's probably not technically the case, and it's probably just an imagination, but I feel like there's a lot of top with those cabs and not like a lot of stuff. And 212s just seem to be so much more balanced in the same way that an 810 was, but more compact. So I was always a big fan of those. But of course, 12s are an incredibly unpopular speaker size for bass.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have a single 12 Ashdown cab here, an ABM 112 for home use, which is fantastic, and you know, it's absolutely giggable. I don't know if, you know, I'd miss a bit of that moving air. But then that said, I actually use, for the bulk of my live stuff, I use a single 15. I can't remember if I've spoken about this before, but I had Ashdown make me two of their classic series, their CL range 115s, but they put the 15 in a 410 cabinet
that
it has lots of room. And then I lined the cabinets with cotton wool so that they're, which is how the old Ampeg caps were made.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was, and I started off, you know, touring both of those with the, you know, touring two cabs and one head, but obviously it's space becomes a premium, and people, you know, the rest of the band start sort of asking, why are we touring two 410 sized 15 inch speakers? So I went down to one, which is fine. And I don't think I've ever owned a 410 actually. I think every time I've bought 115s actually, because I played Orange for a while and I had their compact 15. I played Ampeg before that and I had their SVT 15. And before that, I played Ashdown and had their Mag 15 cab. So yeah, I've always only bought 15s. So I'm actually not very well versed, I guess, in that sense to talk about the others. I've just always been put off, especially by 410s. I always thought it was weird that was the standard. But then, you know, I think it's weird that bass players want to sound like pianos these days rather than like basses. But you know, and I think a 410 is the sort of cab that helps towards that kind of a tone, I guess.
Yeah, I think you raise a really good point there as well, which is oft overlooked, which is that the other side of the cab is the actual wood cabinet itself. Like, yeah, we talk so much about speaker size, yeah, but really the shape and the build and the material of the cab is arguably doing half the work.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I did hear your cab when I saw Polymaths. That would have been probably, in November,
yeah,
gone.
Yeah.
I definitely remember it being an Ashdown and it sounding,
yeah,
cool.
I'm one of those.
Both with yourself and Joe Thorpe, who we talked about.
Oh, that's
about
right.
Earlier.
Yeah, it was definitely mine, because definitely Joe Thorpe couldn't bring a bass amp to that tour that I was doing with his band Body Hound. So I think it was always, yeah, all my rig.
The, yeah,
for that one. Yeah.
Yeah, but a mighty gig for bass between both Body Hound and Polymath.
He's a wonderful bass player.
Yeah, absolutely. This bass guitar nerd enjoyed it very much.
Yeah,
but in terms of when you were saying about the 15-inch speaker in a 4x10 enclosure, it reminded me of this super cool cab that I played once, supporting a Japanese band, I think. I'll be red in the face now if I get this wrong. I think the band was called the ZZZs.
Right. Oh, it's a great name.
Yeah, and a super cool band. And you know what they had? They had in an 8x10 enclosure, very clearly hand-built. It was awesome. It was painted all sorts of zany colours. They had a 3x15 in an 8x10 enclosure. There's, yeah, a picture of me playing through it at that gig somewhere, which if I can find it, I'll pop it in the group. But my God, yeah, 3x15 was an experience for sure, especially in that size of enclosure. And
I bet you had to completely re-EQ everything.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I had this, like, I was playing in like a grunge band, who are still going, called Bitch Falcon. I just don't play with them anymore. And it was a super gnarly kind of, I think I might have been using the Aguilar Aggro by then, but it was a super gnarly tone I was after. And I proper had to re-EQ everything. It was absolutely good experience, but a shock to the system in the sense of being so super different to the 4x10 I was used to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have no doubt.
Yeah.
You know, we're running out of time and I do want to squeeze in one more question before we go. But before I do that, does everyone have like a favorite cab, like a cab that they specifically think, not just sort of talking about, oh, generally, you know, I like 610s or, you know, I like 215s. What is there, like a cab that you think is absolutely the best cab you've ever played through, or the best cab that you think's available, or, you know, at all?
I mean, I do, and it would be, it's any of the Eden, like XST or XLT. Difference is one port for the XST and two ports for the XLTs. Like, they're so hefty, but the throatiness in them is really sort of, they're the classic Eden cabs you see if you see anyone playing Eden cabs. But a specific one is, I don't have it anymore, but I used to have two of, probably only about a dozen in the world, of the Eden. They had the two tens in a wedge configuration,
right?
And yeah, like, it was, I only know two other players who had them, and we all loved them because it was just great, because I'd have my regular rig and I'd run that as an extension, just basically have my own monitor of my own cabs. But like, that's my absolute favorite. But yeah, like any of the 10 inches from Eden and the XLT XST series would be my pick.
I really need to spend more time checking out the Eden cabs. I think I disregarded a lot of their cabs because they were always carpet,
yeah,
rather than Tolex.
Not anymore.
Yay.
Yeah.
Yeah, same here. I definitely want to check out more of the Eden stuff. I'm gonna potentially be a little predictable, but I absolutely love, the few times I've got to play them, it's been a small handful, maybe gigged them 3-4 times, tried them off stage twice, but the Aguilar DB2x12.
Are those the vintage style ones?
Yes, they are indeed.
So they have like quite an over the top Tolex and stuff.
Yes, they? Monster Green is my particular choice. They did like a white chocolate burgundy Tolex. They had another one as well.
Does it have like, is it like, does it have a Vox style top, that range? Like almost the Tolex covers part of the front of the speaker as well, or am I?
No. Oh, remembering that I think you're thinking of the SL, the Superlux.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah, they have like a, they have a corner off that does cover.
That's right.
Yeah.
And was it white and chocolate, or was it white chocolate? Because it seems silly to call it white chocolate, because it's just a way to describe white.
So I'm talking about a cream color.
Oh, yeah. I was like, did they call it white chocolate? I was like, couldn't you just call it cream or white?
I wouldn't be a good co-host if I didn't just make up finishes and colors on the spot. And
I love it.
Later, scream into the void as I fact check after the fact. Sorry, yeah, so the DB2x12 is an absolutely monster cab. I mean, as I've mentioned several times by now, I'd say I'm generally quite a big fan of Aguilar.
They're quite expensive, aren't they, those cabs?
Yeah, they're not cheap. I mean, even still, you're coming in around the £1,300-1,400 mark, roughly. And what I'm dying to try, purely for how the SL112 was, which I used to own, and always wanted a second of, is the SL212. So that's that same super light range that they did the 112 in initially. So yeah, the thing weighed, I mean, it felt like it weighed about 500 grams in my hand. So that in a 212 already is quite attractive, but I hope I get to hear how it sounds sometime. Yeah.
Very cool indeed. My choice for this is super lame, because it's got that sort of importance from when you just started getting into something, and so something has I can't think of the words for it, but you know, when you listen to an old record and you know that it might be an old pop punk record and you know it's bad, but you still have a little bit of nostalgia. There we are. I got there in the end. It's a bit of a nostalgic choice for me, but it's something I've never owned. I wish I owned, and I might have to go out and hunt down because they're discontinued now. But Hartke released their AK series, which was, they were vintage inspired. So they were trying to look a bit Ampeggy. Whereas, you know, Hartke are really known for like their sort of aluminium fronted, aluminium coned high drive series.
And of course, the
VXs, which were in every cheap rehearsal studio, you know, up and down the country here. I don't know. Yeah, I assume they were in the States as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. but the AK series was like Tolex. They were cotton wool lined as standard, which is actually where I got my idea from with the Ashdown. And they kind of had this Ampeggy feel. And when Billy Sheehan stopped playing Ampeg and he moved to Hartke, at first he played the AK series. He only stopped playing AK when they were discontinued, and he plays High Drive now. But I kind of get the feeling that he wishes he was playing the AKs still. But he had he was playing through a couple of their 15s for his neck pickup and the 410s for his P pickup. Was how he was wiring things. But for me, the AK-115, I was just like, it was on wheels. They were really slim. They were almost as slim as guitar cabs. You know, they weren't very deep at all. You know, just white piping. They were just cool and simple and retro. They didn't cost any money, but for some reason, they sounded fantastic.
Well, I mean, I think that as we're talking about cabinets making so much difference, and I was shuddering in horror with 315s being in a standard size cabinet. Just, like, what's the air going to do? But like thinking about them, those Hartke AKs being so small is what made them sound like the old records that we listened to is like that's what the cabinets were. Like, no one did the maths on it yet, that it was like, oh, these should actually be ported and or really deep because like the air just has to go someplace. But
exactly, you're completely right. Like, from a kind of that mathematical perspective, they weren't well designed. They were just cool vintage cabs, and I think I will forever have a soft spot for Hartke as being one of those brands that I don't really know what they're trying to do. Like, they've ignored every instinct to sort of modernize or change their range or, you know, anything. Like, the Hartke logo looks like it should be on the front of a dishwasher. You know, I love everything about it.
The thing about, like, even just looking at Larry Hartke is, like, he looks exactly like he probably did when he was in his 20s. Or something, you know, like, it's like, this is a highly stylized look. I'm staying with it, you know, for the rest of my life. Same, like, and you're just like, good on you. Like, just, do your thing. Yeah, he's great.
No wonder Billy Sheehan's working with him. I mean, Billy Sheehan could literally work with any bass brand in the world. Yeah. And it's like, you know, Hartke aren't exactly cutting edge anymore, but Billy Sheehan's still sticking with them. And I kind of think that's, you know... Yeah, that's they're cool. They're cool. I'm gonna have to go and buy some Hartke stuff now.
Yeah, and they're backed up with good gear as well. Yeah. You know, all of this would be a different conversation if there wasn't good gear to back it up. But I mean, you know, the reason they're popping up, the reason we've had good, you know, respective good experiences with them and are still rating them is that very fundamentally the gear is good. It's the same with Yamaha. You know, Yamaha have not been the coolest marketers of exciting new instruments that have come out. It's like, oh, Yamaha released something, and it's like amazing build quality. It, you know, it plays wonderfully. It does everything it's supposed to do, but it still doesn't have that shouting from the rooftops element that so many other brands around them do.
For sure.
I'm really, I know we're trying to get to another question. I'm just really into
I
this.
Don't think we're going to. It's fine. Great. I've been, just stick on this.
Then I'm really into this idea of you, Joe, like every tour just basically being like some sort of like Barbie where it's like, and now Joe's playing his Hartkes, and you know, like, just like each tour is like you playing completely different gear. Like, you have, this is Joe's Entwistle phase, and this is Joe's like Billy Sheehan, like Hartke Yamaha, like attitude bass, like for one tour.
we've only just started, you know, band practicing again over the last month. So we've had like 4 or 5 practices, my band, and our saxophone player is relatively new. He's been with us a while now, like a year now, but only because, you know, there's been lockdown for half a year. And of course, when he was with us before, we were preparing for a tour, so my gear was consistent. But over the last 4 or 5 weeks, you know, I've turned up, and every week I turn up with a different bass, and like I've changed something on my pedal board. And he commented on it last week. He was like, are you ever going to turn up and like sound the same? Because it's kind of important for everyone else that you have a consistency of tone. And because I'm just like, this week I played, like, I had the 57P bass. The week before that, I was like, I've got this new Ashdown bass with 2 massive, like, 8-pole Musicman pickups, which sounds nothing like anything else. And every week I do turn up with a different bass. I'm sure it's a pain for everyone.
I say stick with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
We're loving it. You've got yourself a safe space here. Also, have you asked him if he has considered starting his own saxophone podcast?
Yeah.
Many gear joys that it would bring him.
Yes, I've doubt it would.
Look, mate, just because you have like one metal tube you blow in doesn't mean that, like, I mean, to be fair, he's probably got a saxophone podcast. He's talking about, like, I use this reed today, you know, and like, you know, it's like, no one even noticed, you know, and like all that kind of stuff.
He does have a hard time learning the polymath stuff, because me and Tim tune in either Fripp standard or D standard, but we talk in 440, we talk in E standard. So when we describe the note, as in the fret we're on, we talk
in E.
Oh dear, I see where this is going. Oh, and our poor sax player's like, no, this isn't in F. This isn't in an F at all. This is in, I don't know, you know, it's like.
Because is he is he double transposing then?
Yeah, because he has to. He obviously
has to transpose anyway, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. The sax has to transpose anyway, and then he has to do it. Yeah, he has to do it again. And of course, me and Tim brings two guitars, and I bring two basses, both in the different tunings. So he has to double transpose in a different way depending on which guitar we're playing. So it's.
Oh my God, you just don't make it easy.
Have you heard of MIDI?
Well, he's basically, he gave, for Christmas, he gave me like a music theory book and was like, just please.
do you need me to show up as a translator?
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't help when we're in C, tuning in fifths, and describing everything in E standard is definitely not helpful for anyone. But
my
yes.
God.
Yeah,
it's like a secret code. It's like, make sure no Russians can play your something.
I'm being like us style. I'm being reminded of traumatic moments in my cover band back in Dublin where we'd have like a 9-piece booked for a gig and be getting our productive but last minute rehearsals in. Hmm. And the singer would have had to transpose one of the requests by like 3 tones or something, right. And I'll never forget. I forget the key, but we had to do Ain't No Mountain for one gig. It was like a 4th up or something like this.
Right.
And as something I had played, like, you know, I knew that part absolutely inside out, but we had the singer singing a different key, the whole band melodically was in a different key. And then I'll never forget the poor brass guys who had shown up just for this gig as well.
Oh, no.
And I was usually, you know, in my amateur way, like MDing the sort of band. And I was, someone asked me for a note at one point in it, and I was like, everyone needs to stop playing until we figure this out. Yeah, so my heart goes out to your saxophonist. Oh,
yes. Poor fella. Before we go, do you remember those Harkey amps that became really popular for a brief time that were dead simple and they were like valve preamp, but they just had like, they were incredibly cheaply made. They had a piece of foam covering the valve on the front for some reason. Do you remember this? And like the piece of foam could fall out. They did a 500 and a 1,000 watt, I think.
Yeah,
it was.
Yeah, this rings
LS,
a bell.
LS500 and LS1000, I think that was it, or was
LX,
was that it?
I know,
because of course the head we all go on about is the HA 550, yeah. And 350 LH,
there you go.
500 and the LH.
There's the 1000. Yep.
I've played these. I absolutely love these. No gain stage.
Yeah.
I love that they were like, hey, what do you think this needs? Do you think this needs gain or just a volume and a 3-band? Oh, yeah, no, that's fine. We definitely don't need gain, but shove
exactly.
put a limiter on there, because that's that's more important. Make sure we've got a treble boost and a limiter.
Yeah,
no
what gain. What can get the chop here? I know, it's gain.
Yeah.
I love it.
Sort of have the gain stage with the whole like active v passive inputs that the bass amp companies love to put on basses, like bass amps. But I forgot about those.
They were wonderful. They were like, if you wanted something to be as clean as possible, it was absolutely these, and the 500 was more than enough. Like the 1000 was crazy.
The 1000 was loud AF.
Oh, it was.
It was in a few backlines that I played and chose to use out of morbid curiosity instead of my tone hammer. And I mean, volume wise, they punched. They absolutely punched.
The problem with them for me was that I think they worked in some situations and absolutely not in others. Like they weren't versatile. But they were incredibly bright and incredibly clean. And like I saw, like the John Niblock, the bass player from Vassa, played one for a brief period of time. And the problem with that was he plays 6-string active basses, and I was just like, oh, so today it is Vassa's drummer and the click of the tweeter for the next 30 minutes. You know, it's just, it was overpowering string noise. you know, from a sort of six string bass. It just didn't work at all. But, you know, put pop a P bass through something like that and it would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's just a good shout for Harkey in general, is that, like, I know we talked about them before, but the HA3500, like, I used to run two of those into 810s if we wanted to, and did two separate 810 SVTs. That was my stereo rig.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it was unneeded, but it was very heavy. But, like, those, I mean, as far as, like, solid amps you could still get for next to nothing. And I had the black and blue face ones, which I think, like, they had the 10-band graphic equalizer with, like, the like, LED lights in each of the bands that,
you know, very cool.
It was the mid-late 90s. It looked rad, you know.
And it also had a contour on it, a low-pass and a high-pass contour. And then you had the two preamps, the solid and the valve front end, and a built-in compressor as well.
Yeah, the two valve preamps were great because, like, it would be like, and they were both always on. It was just how much you brought in. So it wasn't like you had those and you blended them. It was just like they're equal throughout.
Oh, really? I did used to blend them because I used to turn off, you could turn off that 10 band. And then I just used to blend the tube and the solid state. Solid state for treble, essentially, and tube for everything else.
Yeah, I did my solid state for a little bit of oomph in the lows. But, But yeah, like it was, so I like had the highs, you know, the two, I mean, they blend, but it's basically like volume, you know, so it's like volume controls where there's, it's not like you set those and then there's like a guide between these. It's the volume of the preamps.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's one of the amps, like I have like my nostalgic affinity for that. I'd be like, I'd really like, I don't know how and when I would really use it, but like if I wanted to have an amp or something at a practice space and, you know, I didn't want to take one of my like Edens or something like that, I'd be like, yeah, I'm just leave it there. You know, like that's my amp I leave in a rough part of town.
Incredibly affordable and incredibly good. They're still made.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're still in production.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. There can't be a head is still in production that's been in production as long as this.
And cheap too.
Yeah, and cheap too. I mean, well, yeah. I mean, you can buy a new one for £465. I'm looking at one of the Silverface ones on eBay that someone's popped in a Tolex cabinet with a little Hartkey logo. That might have been how they did it, maybe for a bit, or maybe the Hartkey surround is there. It is £200. Buy it now. Oh no, he's reduced it. It's £150. Am I just going to buy this? All right. If I can find If I can find an AK cab, I'm going to purchase this. We'll see. I'm going to have a look, which means... Oh, no, it's missing one of its banded EQs. Oh, I don't want that. No.
What configuration of AK I meant to ask you, Joe?
It doesn't really matter, the 410 or the 15, because I'm just so nostalgic for them. It would be the 15 if I could. But,
but you're into both.
At this point, I just want to own some old Hartkey gear.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, so lovely, so wonderful. Anyway, because I'm going to go on a Hartkey hunt, you guys have got me all excited for Hartkey gear. We're going to have to draw this podcast to a close. So you can, of course, dear listener, join us on all the social media platforms with @GuitarNerds and check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/GuitarNerds. And we'll be back the week after next with more of this bass guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style?
Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.